This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, our next guest is one of the most passionate advocates of Michigan wines and no stranger to this program. She is Linda Jones, Executive Director of the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council. Always a welcome guest, especially this time of the year. Linda, great to see you again.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Kirk.
We're going to talk about a lot of great programs and a lot of great wines, but let's start out where we typically do, a little snapshot of the importance of the grape and wine industry to the state of Michigan.
Well, the wine industry is really making a great contribution on a number of ways to the Michigan economy because it participates in two of our very important economic sectors, agriculture and tourism. And when those two worlds collide, we get many benefits to the economy. So when people travel around the state and visit wineries, they will stay at hotels, they will stay dine out, they will purchase souvenirs. And so wine tourism really is the foundation of an emerging wine region. And Michigan is well situated in the top 10 states in the country for wine.
Now, this growth in the Michigan wine industry has been a phenomenon that's been going on for quite some time now, but it wasn't always so. And I know Michigan State University and Stan Howell and people like that had a lot to do with the... But wasn't at one time Michigan primarily a Concord grape-producing state?
And we still are a very large Concord and Niagara grape-producing state. Welch's has a very strong presence here. They have a processing plant in Lawton, Michigan, and actually the majority of the acres that you see around the state are those varieties that are grown for jams, jellies, and juices. And for many years, people in Michigan did try to make wine from them, and they were popular with a certain demographic. But as consumers started to travel the world and experience the fine wines of Europe, they wanted those drier styles. And so when they came back and were talking to their local wineries, the wineries realized that they needed to make a shift in their production. And that required finding the grapes that they would need to make those styles of wine. We tried growing vinifera varieties that they grow in Europe that people are familiar with, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and we found that there's a limit to where they can be grown in the state. So there's a zone near Lake Michigan and in some other parts of the state that those varieties can grow. But there are very nice hybrid varieties that are more hardy. And with the support of Michigan State University viticulturalists, they were able to determine which varieties would thrive in certain areas of the state. And now we have a lovely map that Dr. Ron Perry has helped us to develop that shows where these different groupings of varieties can be grown that are suitable for wine production.
And again, Ron Perry is another one of those names that's been involved for a very, very long time, and a good friend of mine as well. But the growth then, since this has occurred, Linda, the growth in the number of wineries has been rather astounding. It's been a great success story in a state that's frankly been battered by some tough economic news the last 10 to 15 years.
That's so true. And really, agriculture has carried the economy over the last 10 years, and the wine industry has been proud to be part of that. I find that the reason that people like to get into the wine industry is because it combines so many different areas. It's agriculture, it's technology, if you've seen a packaging line, a bottling line. It's creativity with the winemaking, the art on the wine labels, the design of the tasting room, and it's hospitality, interacting with consumers and talking about what you're very passionate about, and then business. So when you combine all of those elements, it's a very attractive industry to be part of. It's a very expensive one to get involved in, but we really have seen a growth in this kind of agricultural value-added entrepreneurship in the state. And we see that with dried cherries and agritourism, a whole different wine is just one element of that experiential aspect of how we want to spend our leisure time. We want to engage in something that's authentic, that we can feel very connected to. And there's many things in agriculture that provide that, tours of cheese plants and dairies. And wine is really the shining star that is the poster child for value-added agriculture. You take a few dollars worth of grapes, you make wine out of them, a $10 or $12 bottle of wine, you create a weekend experience, and all of a sudden you've created $150 to $200 worth of economic value to the local community through that bottle of wine.
My guest is Linda Jones, and she is the executive director of the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council. And speaking of helping people to promote and market and getting the word out, a lot of folks might be good viticulturalists, good enologists, but maybe they don't have a real strong marketing background. But that's what you folks do at the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council. You're helping to sell and promote Michigan wines.
Yes, we have a basic platform of promotion for the industry, and that what we encourage is the industry to build their brands on top of that. We encourage the wineries to do their own brand development as well. We also have a network of wine trails around the state that are promoting their regions very effectively, and that's been very gratifying to see those regional wine trails evolve and take control of their destiny from a marketing standpoint and lure consumers to their area.
And typically, a lot of people think of Northwest Michigan or Southwest Michigan for wine trails, but there have been the proliferation of wine trails in other parts of the states as well.
That's right. We've got a wine trail in Southeast Michigan. We have one on the Sunrise side in the Alpena area. And we have a West Central trail. And we have new trails under discussion in the Thumb, Petoskey, and in the UP. So we're seeing little nuclei of wineries happening all around the state, and with the advent of new varieties that are being developed by plant breeders now, we actually have varieties that will thrive in the Upper Peninsula. And that's a frontier that we're starting to push and see some exciting. It'll take some time for those wines to kind of settle into what styles are best with those varieties, such as Frontenac and Marquette are two of the wine grape varieties that are very, very cold hardy, and we're starting to see those being planted in some of our colder regions of the state.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, if they're going to be growing in the Upper Peninsula, although there is a temperature trend that suggests that there's some warming going on, but I still, for the foreseeable future, those varieties are going to have to be pretty cold hardy.
Yep, they will. And they're very high yielding varieties too, so that's a bonus.
Well, as we move into the holiday season, Linda, let's talk a little bit about about some of the things that people can do when they're selecting their wines, some recommendations that you might make for gifts or for the table. Let's start with one that's a favorite of mine, but the whole ice wine phenomenon.
Sure. Ice wine makes a fantastic gift at the holidays. It's very special, and it's got a very usually packaged in a very beautiful bottle by the wineries. So ice wine is made by World Trade Agreement by leaving grapes on the vines through the winter until it gets to a certain low temperature. And when it reaches that certain low temperature, overnight usually is the coldest part of the day, they harvest those grapes and press them. And because the grapes are frozen, they get a very, very sweet concentrated juice out of those grapes that are then fermented into wine and makes a very sweet wine from those grapes. And you will see the vineyard laborers out and the owners out all dressed up in their parkas.
In their parkas,
harvesting. a call will go out at 2 in the morning and everybody's on alert that we might be harvesting ice wine tonight.
Because of that temperature, right?
That has to reach that critical temperature, so they keep an eye on that. And usually it's in mid to late December or January. But the wineries do take a risk of leaving those grapes on the vine for ice wine, because if it doesn't get cold enough, then they have no production from those grapes.
And if they get too cold, then I suspect that it's bad news as well. Does the grape actually then freeze at that temperature?
It's almost like a little buckshot. but they can still squeeze them and get juice out of them.
And it's primarily, as you mentioned, very sweet. Well, I've had it. A dessert wine, and it's absolutely delicious.
It's great to go with desserts, holiday desserts, yes.
Well, let's switch from ice wine to the whole Riesling saga.
Right. Well, Riesling is our most widely planted grape in Michigan, and we make Riesling in a number of styles. Consumers find Riesling very confusing for that reason. But we make dry Rieslings that are very food-friendly. And then for some of the sweeter dishes that we tend to have over the holidays, a semi-dry Riesling goes very well. And then on the dessert side, we have late harvest Riesling, and the ice wines are often made from Riesling as well. So there's a lot of choices in Riesling, and we're very good at make a lot of them.
Now, is Riesling, for those of us who know a little bit about wines, but is that originally a German grape that has been transplanted here in the United
yes,
States?
Yes, yes. It did originate in Germany. One of the Germany is well known for its Rieslings, and Michigan producers are a member of an organization called the International Riesling Foundation. So we have wineries in Michigan, Washington State, New York State that are all members of that organization and are leaders globally in the International Riesling Foundation.
Linda, let's talk about a program that is very exciting. I think the perfect holiday gift, the perfect Christmas gift, Vintage Michigan.
Yes, we have a wonderful program called the Vintage Michigan Loyalty Program. And for a lifetime membership of just $15, you can become a card-carrying member of the Vintage Michigan Club. And you'll receive a membership card that you can take to many of the wineries around the state. It also provides discounts at the wineries and many retailers, restaurants, and even some lodging properties. And we keep an up-to-date list of the participating vendors who offer discounts. So you can check our website frequently to find out what the latest discounts are that are available with your Vintage Michigan card. I believe we have over 120 participating businesses that offer discounts with the Vintage Michigan card. And along with your membership, you can receive a free cork puller or a bottle stopper that has the Michigan logo on it.
And what better logo than a Michigan logo?
Yes.
How many members so far?
We have.
What an exciting
very
program.
Very exciting. We've really ramped it up the last couple of years. We have now over 3,600 members, and we're very, very pleased to grow that program.
Well, it's almost like carrying one of those great cards that you can get into the state parks or the national parks, and now you've got a card where you take it to the wineries or other maybe restaurants or what have you, and you're going to get a deal.
Right, and it's very easy to order these memberships. We have an online order form at www.michiganwines.com, and if you're going to order these for the holidays, I encourage you to do that early. It does take us about a week to get those turned around and mailed out to folks, so there is a gift option if you want to purchase one for a gift. There is the ability to do that as well, all on our website or by contacting our office.
Well, Linda, the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council, you mentioned the website. It's a wonderful website, but you always have events going on, special events, et cetera. What are some things that are happening in the next few weeks around the great state of Michigan?
Sure. We maintain a lovely events calendar, and we also have a trip planner tool on our new website where you can plan your trip if you want to pick a few wineries to visit. But the wineries do a fantastic job of offering special events, and in the winter is a great time to visit the wineries because the tasting rooms are quiet. And if you want to really expand your wine knowledge, that's a perfect time because the people in the tasting room have more time to talk with you than they do on the busy Saturdays in October when people are lined up 10 deep at the tasting bar. So we really encourage people to take advantage of the wonderful events that are going on in January and February. Look ahead on the calendar and see what events many of the wineries offer. Cooking classes. There are regional events at restaurants and community colleges, fundraising events. There's events coming up in Hillman, Michigan, a Wine Lovers Weekend. And I saw an event in Douglas, Michigan, and in Durand. So really all over the state, there's always events going on. And there's a little bit of a lull right around the holidays when the winery staff want to take a break and be home with their families too. But in January, they really are a lot of different things available. And you could give a gift certificate to one of those events as a Christmas gift if you wish.
One question, and you mentioned wine tasting, but one question that I've asked at different venues and wonderful wine tasting venues, people may learn the vocabulary of wine, learn some of the cooking recipes, et cetera, what wines go with what foods, et cetera. What about one's palate? I mean, is it simply, some people seem to really have a palate where they can detect all the nuances of the wine, and maybe other people don't. Is palate something that you can develop?
Certainly it is, and I would agree with you. It's a challenge. It's a frustration to me being in this position for 15 years that I don't feel I have as discerning a palate as others that I've tasted with, and I'm trying to, like many of us, trying to improve that, and I think it's just a matter of practice, practice, practice. And going to the tasting room is the best way to do that because when you can compare two or three things side by side and offer your observations on those wines to the person behind the tasting room bar, they're really going to be able to help you because of their great experience. help you understand why you're tasting what you're tasting and why you like what you like, so that when you go to choose a wine at a retailer, when you don't perhaps have the opportunity to taste, you're going to have a much higher probability of selecting something that you will enjoy. So it definitely is something that people need to, if they want to be very proficient at wine tasting, take some work. But I do believe that there are some differences inherently in our physiology that makes it a little bit easier or harder to make those distinctions.
My guest is Linda Jones, Executive Director of the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council. And speaking of tasting rooms while we're on that, one of the really, I call it a byproduct or an advantage of tasting rooms, is not just learning from the folks behind the counter, but the conversations that you have with the folks next to you at the counter too, many of whom might be connoisseurs, and they can supplement the knowledge of the person who owns the winery with their own.
Well, that's a great point, and it sounds like you've had some experience yourself with that, Kirk.
I have definitely had some experience.
The tasting rooms. But yes, it's a challenge for the tasting room staff to figure out what the general wine knowledge is of a person that's walking up to the tasting room bar. We like to call it tasting room triage, trying to quickly figure out what level people are at and how to gear the tasting to that person's level of interest and experience. And our staff in the tasting rooms do a great job of that. But that's part of the fun of it. When you go to the tasting rooms, you never know who else you're going to meet along the way. And now that the wineries are able to serve food at the tasting rooms, they're expanding their food service menus a little bit. I am finding that people are lingering longer and perhaps ordering a little appetizer and a glass of wine and sitting out, not in January, but sitting out and admiring the vineyards and meeting people. And that whole social aspect of the tasting room experience, I think, is something that is really driving the more than 2 million visitors a year that we have to Michigan tasting rooms.
And speaking of those 2 million visitors, another thing that you hear anecdotally, but you probably have some data on it, are more and more people coming to Michigan from out of state and out of our region now as Michigan wines become more well-known and more popular?
Definitely. And I think that there are a couple of things are at play here. One is our highly successful Pure Michigan travel campaign. So that message is reaching people in far-flung states. And we're seeing a lot more license plates in the tasting rooms from Mississippi, Texas, Alabama. The wineries report that back. And also, Michigan is gaining more reputation for its quality wine production. And so people aren't afraid to go into a Michigan winery tasting room now that might be unfamiliar. So I think that we're doing the job of getting the reputation and the knowledge out there. We have a lot of our wines distributed quite far in the Midwest now. So when people come from Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, they always already have some experience with Michigan wines, even if this is their first visit to a winery in Michigan.
One final initiative that the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council is deeply involved in and provides a lot of leadership for, and let's talk a little bit, and we did last year, the Michigan Culinary Tourism Alliance. That's a big word or a big phrase, but what is the Culinary Tourism Alliance?
Well, culinary tourism... wine is very connected with culinary tourism, and research around the globe indicates that more and more, with the advent of the internet and cable TV channels, people are choosing where they travel because of some food or wine destination that they have in mind. So people will do a lot of research ahead of time. They'll pick the restaurants they want to go to. They'll pick the wineries, the breweries, the cideries, the cheese farms, the apple orchards that they want to visit. So all around the world, regions are developing and promoting their culinary tourism assets in a better way so that people know what they can expect to experience when they come to an unfamiliar region. And of course, with the diversity of agriculture that we have here in Michigan, what a more perfect place to experience food than here in Michigan. And when you add in the fish from the Great Lakes, Morel mushrooms and maple syrup, we really have a selection of raw materials to work from that is unparalleled. So we're really working hard, and the Michigan Wine Industry Council is leading this because we know that if people recognize Michigan as a foodie destination, interest in our wines will follow, because when they go to a restaurant that serves local foods, they'll be looking for local wines to enjoy with that. So there's a Michigan Culinary Tourism Alliance that we have been leading for about 5 years. It's a very informal network of people that are involved in the farm market industry. We have folks from Eastern Market, the Henry Ford, the different resorts around the state, agritourism, breweries, cideries, everybody that touches this culinary experience. Chefs, convention and visitors bureaus, hotels that are well known for their food, all of those folks need to network and form partnerships where we can have packages. So hotels can offer an overnight package that features a dinner at a local restaurant that features local cuisine, or a coach tour out to see some ag tourism attractions while they're there. So we're starting to see these packages being developed, and the Michigan Culinary Tourism Alliance is the networking place where people can connect with others who have an interest in this and developing it further. And it is part of the tourism strategic plan that's being implemented at the moment with Michigan State University's leadership as well.
Well, and another exciting development for the great state of Michigan. Well, it is the holiday season. Get those Michigan wines. Take a look at that vintage Michigan Club. I'm definitely going to buy a couple of those, if not more, Linda.
Great.
What an exciting development that is. But it's always great to see you. It is Linda Jones. She is the executive director of the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council. Linda, it's always great having you on the program, and happy holidays to you.
And same to you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
As we're moving into the holiday season, and that means our annual visit with resident Christmas tree expert Bert Craig. Bert is an associate professor in Michigan State University's Department of Horticulture and in the Department of Forestry. Bert, always good to see you, especially this time of the year.
Good to be here.
Last year we talked, we had some pretty dry weather, and it affected the Christmas tree crop. What about this year? We've had a pretty good summer, I suspect.
Yeah, this has been a really good season for most of our growers. Always, you know, it's a lot of variation because we cover, you know, basically the whole state. And so, you know, things vary from region to region. But by and large, it was a good growing season, certainly much better for folks than 2012.
Before we get into some of the specifics that we like to talk about, tree selection and care and all those sorts of things, let's talk about the Christmas tree industry in Michigan and the importance of it. There is a Michigan Christmas Tree Association. What is it that they do, Bert, and how successful is the industry in Michigan?
Well, we've been pretty successful. We've held our position. Michigan ranks third in the U.S. in Christmas tree production, and sort of our calling card is that Michigan growers grow a wider variety of tree species than just about any place else. And, of course, the association has a variety of functions. Largely, it's educational for the growers. We do a lot of programming. Myself, Pascal Zoku from Forestry, Jill O'Donnell, our statewide extension agent. We work with the association for educational programming for the growers. Certainly, it's a marketing association. They have a website for the Michigan Christmas Tree Association. If you do a Google search or any other search for Michigan Christmas trees, should be the first thing you'll hit. And they've got lots of resources there that are very helpful for the consumer. If, for example, you're interested in finding a choose and cut location, they have maps there. If you're a wholesaler looking to sell your trees, they have resources there. So a lot of marketing efforts and education for the public and for the growers.
You mentioned that we're third in Christmas tree production in the United States, Bert. I imagine the Christmas tree farms range in size from relatively small boutique to very large operations. I mean, where are these operations located in Michigan, and what is the range in size of production?
Well, size of production is varies tremendously. There are some people that have just, you know, maybe a few hundred trees that have a small choose and cut operation, up to we have growers that harvest, you know, hundreds of thousands of trees a year. So it's about as big a range as you can imagine. And really located throughout the state, certainly the smaller choose and cut, I imagine if you're anywhere within the sound of my voice here, you're probably not too far from a choose and cut in your location, probably within 15, 20 miles, I would guess just about anybody could find a choose and cut location. The bigger producers tend to be concentrated in a few counties. Wexford County, the Cadillac area, is kind of one of our main production areas for the state.
Let's come back to the number of growers in Michigan. You mentioned, again, we're third in production. Approximately how many growers do we have?
Well, numbers are hard to get a hold of because there's so many of these small growers that aren't part of the association, things like that. I think the association's right at about 200, 250 members. There are probably at least that many, if not more, smaller growers that, again, just have a few hundred trees that maybe aren't part of the association.
Bert, you mentioned that we grow a lot of varieties in Michigan, and I know, and we mentioned the Michigan Christmas Tree Association. What about some work that's going on now between the association and growers and Michigan State Universities, some new genetics that you're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always one of these things where we're always looking, you know, to build the better tree. We've got some great trees, of course, that growers are producing right now, Fraser fir, Concolor fir, Douglas fir, all of these that are great trees for the holidays. One of the things we're always looking for, though, is, you know, how can we do things better? And so one of the things we're working on is a project. It's called the Collaborative Fir Germplasm Evaluation, COFERG. First step in any research is to come up with a good acronym.
Absolutely.
So,
gotta have our acronyms. Absolutely.
And so this is a collaborative effort. We're actually working here at MSU. Pascal Zoku and myself and Jill O'Donnell are working with researchers at Oregon State, Washington State University, North Carolina State, Penn State, and Connecticut. And so it's sort of five regions around the country. And we are looking at new seed sources of Turkish fir, which is obviously from Turkey. It's from the Southern Europe area. And these are trees that have great characteristics for Christmas trees, growth, form, color, but also tend to be resistant to root rots that cause us a lot of problems. And there are, of course, differences around the country in production and species, but one of the things that sort of cuts across everybody is Phytophthora root rot. And so we think with the work with the Turkish firs, this might be a way that we can get around some of these limitations. So that's one big research effort that we've got going, and MCTA and also the Michigan Seedling Growers Association have both contributed to helping with that program. We have two test plantations now that were established, 3,000 seedlings at each location. And so with help from the MCTA and the seedling growers, those have helped to support. We were out planting the trees this year, getting some initial measurements, so that's an ongoing project that they've been helpful in supporting that.
My guest is a good friend, Bert Craig. He's an associate professor in the Michigan State University Department of Horticulture and the Department of Forestry. His work is funded also in part by our good friends at MSU Ag Bioresearch. Bert, we were talking, you mentioned one research project Michigan State's involved in with respect to genetics. What's the second one?
So the second one is a project that is funded through the USDA Specialty Crop Research Initiative. And so what we're doing here, it's very much sort of a basic kind of project looking at actually the genomics of Fraser fir, where we'll be looking at, for example, we mentioned the issues with the Phytophthora root rot.
Right.
And so they will be trying to look for genetic markers that might identify genotypes that are resistant to Phytophthora. So can we use that as a selection criteria then to help, again, breed and develop trees that will be resistant? Also in that genomics work, they will be looking at markers related to needle retention, which is another critical issue. You tend not to think about it unless you work with Christmas trees, but you know, needle retention is a big issue. One of the reasons, or you know, people may get away from real trees and go to artificial trees is, of course, the mess and needle retention or needle drop. And so identifying traits or a marker that might help us select trees that have better needle retention, obviously in the long term is going to be good for the grove tree industry.
And those Fraser firs have become increasingly popular. I've bought several over the last few years. They're a wonderful tree, but you get rid of the root rot problem and the needle retention issues associated with Fraser fir, and that could really take off.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's really sort of the holy grail, because Fraser fir has so many things going for it. And the needle retention already is excellent with Fraser fir, but of course anything we can do to improve that. And then certainly for the growers, if we can get around the root rot issue, it's going to really expand the locations where they can grow it and increase their overall productivity, no doubt.
Let's talk about another ongoing project that you've been involved with. It's called Make It a Real Michigan Christmas promotion that's been going on for the last several years. And you mentioned some of the problems associated, at least in people's minds, some of the perceptions about messiness, et cetera. What are some of the results that have come out of the surveys you've done that have been associated with that program?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the survey at work was actually done by Bridget Behe, so I want to make sure we acknowledge that. And the interesting thing that came out of that, at least to me, was that there's still a fairly sizable segment of the population that believes that artificial trees are more environmentally friendly than real trees. And there's been several different studies done, life cycle analyses, where they track, you know, carbon footprints and all of this. And basically, there is almost no difference. You can, a lot of this depends on the assumptions you want to make. The biggest environmental impact when you look at it is really, for a real tree, is how far you drive to go get your tree. So in terms of the production, so forth.
So as far as carbon footprint,
yeah,
it's your fuel.
The amount that goes into the production of the tree is really relatively small, actually, in both cases. And so you can make a artificial tree look better in this type of analysis if you say that you're going to hang on to it for a long time, 15, 20 years, and you're going to have to drive a long way each year to get your real tree.
Okay? You have a bigger denominator,
right,
basically.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, but on the other hand, if you are someone who is going to go get a real tree and you're making a stop on a trip you would have made anyway, or those kind of things, then obviously it's a different calculation. So you can make it work out almost any way you want to. So really overall, the environmental benefits probably weigh out more in favor of the real tree, in the sense that you're not dealing with polyvinyl chloride and all these other sorts of chemicals that go into the manufacture of an artificial tree. The other big thing, of course, is when you look at it for Michigan and really anywhere else in the country, is that when you're buying a real tree, you're supporting, you know, local farms, local growers right here at home. Most of these growers that we deal with in the association are family farms, some second, third generation. And so when you're buying a real tree, going to a choose and cut, or buying a tree from a local lot here, you know, you're keeping your money here in our economy and supporting our local jobs.
Yeah, and another thing, too, relative to those artificial trees, I mean, when you dispose of those, then you've got an issue. I mean, some of the materials that go into those trees are not biodegradable, whereas you dispose of a real Christmas tree, there are any number of uses you can make of wood chips for trails or what have you. So there's that advantage as well.
Yeah. And lots of programs. Most communities now have some type of Christmas tree recycling program. Some places like East Lansing, you just can take it to the curb. Other places have central recycling locations. So it's pretty easy to get that tree, you know, into some other use. The other thing that came out of the survey that I want to mention is the issue that there's still a pretty large perception that real trees are a big fire hazard. And the important thing people have to remember is the key to keeping a tree fresh, to keep it safe, to make it keep its needles, is keeping water to it. And so if you allow a tree to dry, and it can become a fire hazard, that there's no getting around that. But as long as you keep water in that stand and keep the tree hydrated, it is difficult, almost impossible, to ignite a Christmas tree with common household sources. So a well-watered tree is not a fire hazard. Dry tree is a different story. So we want to make sure that we get the word out to people. A rule of thumb is that your stand should hold at least a quart for each inch of diameter of the butt of that tree, of the cut end of that tree. And so make sure you get a stand that's large enough. A lot of them aren't, so make sure you get a stand that's large enough. And check those trees, especially every day for the first week or two, because when you first bring them in the house, they'll really suck up a lot of water, so I want to make sure we keep water to those trees, especially first couple weeks.
My guest is Bert Craig. He's a Christmas tree expert, Michigan State University. He works with MSU Extension, also MSU Ag Bioresearch. Bert, other tips with the selection and care of trees? Of course, you mentioned the importance of watering, which is probably the most important, but other things that our consumers should know, our listeners should know when they're looking for a Christmas tree, a real Christmas tree.
Yeah, probably the biggest thing is making sure that the tree is fresh when you get it. And, of course, if you're going to choose and cut place, that's pretty straightforward because you know exactly when that tree was taken. If you're getting it from a tree lot, you want to do a couple of things. I recommend what's sometimes called the shake test or the drop test, where you sort of tap the, if you can, pick up the tree and sort of tap the bottom of that tree on the ground if there's concrete or something there, and tap that tree lightly on the bottom of the ground. You shouldn't see any needles dropping out of that tree. If you see a lot of needles starting to drop, that
tree's
probably been allowed to dry out, so you want to look for a different tree. Run your fingers along the stem of the and see if any of the needles are coming off in your hand. That's usually a pretty good test. Some people will bend one of the branches, see if it'll snap. It should have some give to it, some bend. And then once you bring that tree home, if you're bringing it home from a tree lot, is to cut about an inch or so off the bottom base of that tree. Make a new cut on the bottom there. That will help the tree to take up water. What happens is those cut ends, there's resin in those wood of that tree, and that'll begin to plug those pores at the bottom of the tree. They're really like a bunch of little straws there for the tree to
take
up water.
Like the xylem and the phloem, if I'm remembering my biology.
I was trying to avoid the technical terms there. But yeah, the xylem of the tree there, they really are like little straws. And so when those get plugged with the resin flow, then the tree has trouble taking up water. So recut that end. That'll help the tree to continue to take up water and then just keep water to it once you bring it in the house.
You know, Bert, you mentioned the economic advantages of real trees, and we mentioned some of the environmental, but there's also the whole element of a family going out and cutting or selecting a Christmas tree, which is really family, and so we refer to it as social sustainability. There are many reasons from a sustainability standpoint why we take a real live tree.
Yeah, absolutely, and if you've never done a choose and cut before, you know, try it one time. It's a great experience, but yeah, you go out there and you can see all the families. Some people bring their dogs with them, and you know, people talk about the experience economy, and it's really more about, you know, the whole family outing as much as it is the tree. And build memories with your family. People be out there with the video cameras, and it's just a great experience.
Yeah, and I think experiential marketing, it's the whole ag tourism growth, the experience of going out and actually doing this, getting out from behind the computer screen and doing something with the family out in nature.
Absolutely.
Well, I've been talking with Bert Craig. Bert is an associate professor in the Michigan State University Department of Horticulture and the Department of Forestry. Bert, you have a great holiday season. Always a pleasure to see you on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Yeah, great to be here, Kirk. Thank you.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Jason Clay. Jason is the Senior Vice President Markets for the Washington, D.C.-based World Wildlife Fund, Jason and the fund works with some of the largest corporations in the world toward a common goal, and I'm going to quote, a more sustainable planet where human needs are met in harmony with nature. Jason, it's been a while, but so good to talk to you again.
Thank you. Thanks. It's good to be back.
Before we get into a couple of very compelling current projects, can you give our listeners an overview of the work of the World Wildlife Fund in general and your work specifically?
So our work is what you'd expect with an organization that has a panda for a logo. We've worked on species and protecting species from extinction. We then worked on the places that you need, the habitat that they need to live in, and the corridors you need to connect those habitats. But what we did that for about 40 years, and what we've come to realize in the last 10 or 15 is that if we don't get where and how we produce food right, we can turn out the lights and go home, because the threats to the species are actually producing more food and fiber for us. To put that in context, in the next 40 years, we have to produce as much food as we have in the last 8,000. And if we simply, we need to double the amount of food production. If we double it by expanding to twice as much land, then there's going to be nothing left for nature. So we want to figure out how to produce more with less, how to be more efficient. And the work I do is with companies in forest products, in fisheries, in aquaculture, in agriculture, in finance, to help them figure out how to make their supply chains more sustainable, because this is an issue that we have to get right. NGOs don't buy and sell anything, and we don't make laws and regulations, so we've got to figure out how to influence those companies and governments that do those things more.
Jason, I know that you had some recent success where Concept, the Global Market Initiative, actually has translated into some major announcements. Let's go through a couple of those. Let's start with Ireland.
Well, Ireland, about a month ago, the first country ever, committed that 100% of its food exports would be third-party certified as sustainable by 2016. And they're about 30% of the way there. I think they were concerned about market access. I think they were concerned about kind of the horse meat and the fraud and those kinds of issues that we're getting into markets in Europe. But I think the real thing is that they see this as a way to be more sustainable over the long term.
Yeah, and kudos to the Irish. You know, one point that you make in a lot of your work, and you're working with some of the 100 or more of the major companies in the globe, around the globe, with regard to sustainability, but it's in their best interest, their long-term best interest, to ensure that these commodities that they use to produce their products are sustainable. Sometimes people don't get that.
Right, exactly. So I think it's, and it's not insignificant. I mean, 90% of all the beef in Ireland is exported, mostly to Europe. And it's some of the same companies that we all know that buy it. I mean, one of the single biggest supplier of meat to McDonald's in Europe is Ireland. So, you know, that company was actually, you know, working with Ireland to make this commitment because they want a long-term supply.
Well, moving to major companies, I think also a company that you work very closely with, Unilever, has made an announcement with respect to some of its products as well.
Right. So Unilever actually decided that, their CEO decided that there was enough of this talk, and they wanted to make a big commitment around sustainability. They decided that making a commitment that 50% of their raw material supplies didn't really mean very much to people. Why 50%? Why not, you know, more? So they came out with a commitment of 100% of all their raw materials, their bio-based raw materials, would be certified by third parties by 2020. That's about 3,500 raw materials. So that's all the different ingredients they buy to manufacture different products. And I think that once they made that commitment, we've now seen General Mills step up with a commitment with about 50% of the volume of the raw materials they buy being certified as sustainable by 2020. Mars has made the same thing. And we're beginning to see this kind of, not exactly a domino effect, I would say an enlightened self-interest effect, where people see the rationale for this and are beginning to move it forward. And that's the kind of change we're going to need if we are going to be able to maintain this planet going forward.
Jason, just the thought of 3,500 raw materials, if you think along the supply chain, I mean, that is a huge commitment that a corporation would have to make to get third-party certification. That's got to take a lot of time, a lot of planning, and a lot of financial commitment.
It does. I mean, making the commitment's easy. They've got to change the systems inside the company for how they buy products, how they segregate them, how they manufacture, what the specs are, et cetera. And it's, you know, it's ironically, it's easier for the big commodities. Like if it's palm oil, there's a certification program in place. If it's soy, if it's, you know, rice, wheat, whatever. But this also means nutmeg and cinnamon and mace and black pepper and other kinds of ingredients as well.
My guest is Jason Clay. He's a senior vice president for markets for the World Wildlife Fund. And we're talking about some of the wonderful initiatives that he's involved in and that the World Wildlife Fund is supporting, global markets initiatives. But let's take a look at a couple of commodities that are under threat and have been much in the news over the last 10 to 15 years. And these commodities come directly from our wonderful oceans. You've just had a major, I think you call it the Global Salmon Initiative. Tell us a little bit about that.
The Global Salmon Initiative is 15 CEOs of some of the largest salmon aquaculture producing companies. And last August in Norway, on the 15th of August, these companies made a public commitment that by 2020, 100% of their production will be third-party certified as sustainable. What's interesting about it is that they represent 70% of the market of global salmon. And so that is a real game changer. That transforms the whole market, and it actually puts the onus on the other 30% to explain why they're not certified. So we can start seeing the potential to get underpricing for those companies that aren't certified as an incentive to make them better. But I think the real issue was that it wasn't just about market access that was their motivator. It was also about license to operate in the countries they produce in. So they want to produce more salmon, and to do that, they have to convince those countries that they're going to be sustainable. So I think it was that dual edge. They also began to realize that their credibility, or the credibility of salmon from aquaculture, is only as good as the reputation of the worst company. So this, they've decided it's called a pre-competitive approach. They're going to work together on sustainability. And what that means is that they're actually sharing data about how to reduce the key impacts, how to reduce feed use, how to reduce escapes, how to reduce disease and the use of medicines and things like that. They're actually sharing the data between the companies. And their goal is to move the performance of the whole sector up much more quickly than would happen naturally.
What are the tipping points when companies can actually get to that stage?
I think it's actually awareness. And it's awareness in a funny way. It's awareness either of a problem or a chronic long-term kind of issue. A problem, for example, is right now greening as a disease in orange groves. It's a problem that Coke and Pepsi both have to work on because they have billion-dollar brands around this, Minute Maid and Tropicana. If they don't work together on this, we're not going to solve that problem. And there's only about three or four major grower consortiums that they have to work with as well. So that's very doable. It means working together around the long-term viability of a product. There's also more chronic issues like, are we going to have enough of these raw materials, and trying to help everybody get better. And that's where the salmon industry has taken a lead about sharing information, because they want to be able to produce more salmon. I mean, what people don't understand is that aquaculture production is now responsible for more seafood that people on this planet consume than wild-caught fisheries. But aquaculture is also a larger source of animal protein globally than beef is. And that's just happened in the last couple of years. So we need animal protein from efficient sources, but we need it to be produced environmentally sustainably.
My guest is Jason Clay. He's the Senior Vice President for the World Wildlife Fund. Jason, to hear you speak, and we've had several vice presidents of sustainability and CEOs on from companies ranging from Ford to Coca-Cola, but you go out into the environmental groups around here, or you talk to some folks, and they say, well, a lot of these big companies, it's just greenwashing. I mean, they're doing this because it's a good public relations move. It's going to keep their products moving, et cetera. You're working with these companies on a day-to-day basis, and to hear you talk, I mean, this is a commitment that is sincere, that is long-term, and that is philosophically motivated. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, I think go in with your eyes wide open, but if we don't move these companies, we don't make the changes on the ground, because they're the ones buying and selling things. So we need to get them to make commitments, and we need to publicize those commitments, but we also need to each year publish the information about how much they have moved the needle against those commitments. So again, eyes wide open. Let's take them at face value, but as they, you know, as they say in Missouri, you know, trust but verify. Show me, don't tell me. You know, there's been a fundamental shift in the last 35 years or so. In 1975, 83% of the value of a company was based on tangible assets, things like factories and production lines and fleets of vehicles, etc. Today, 81% is based on intangible assets. So it's reputation, it's brand value, etc. If they don't get ahead of this, they lose market share and they lose their value in the markets.
The World Wildlife Fund has teamed up with National Geographic, and I think that it's called Make Each Choice Count. Tell us a little bit about Make Each Choice Count.
We've tried to figure out how to go from the 20th century into the 21st century and start to use electronic media to reach both a bigger audience and a younger audience about these issues. Because, you know, for what we're facing is a situation where anybody 35 or younger is probably the first generation that's going to be affected by climate change and maybe the last generation that has a real ability to impact it without huge costs. And so we need to get them informed, make them aware of the issues, build consensus around strategies, and then begin to shape how we would move forward. The idea with the National Geographic is to create a series of short, kind of two-minute social media videos to tee up issues. One is on, you know, water and energy around cotton production and clothing. WF has done ones around, you know, how much water it takes to make lattes, how much rainforest it takes to make a laptop. Those because of the energy embedded in the aluminum that is used to make the laptop. We're trying to make people think laterally and become aware of issues that they haven't even thought about before. And we're trying to do it not through publications and television programs, but actually through things that they can spread around themselves and that will go viral through social media.
Yes, I watched the one on the impact of the cotton T-shirt, and I will never look at a T-shirt in quite the same way again after watching that video.
How many cotton T-shirts do you actually need? There's one study that shows you, and if you have more than 10, probably you don't need them.
And you don't need to dry them in the dryer every time you wash them. And how often do you need to wash them, right?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, are there ways that we can make cotton so that they are kind of odor and soiled resistant, so you don't have to wash them as often? I mean, there are just lots of new technologies that once we start seeing what the problems are, we can start managing those and measuring them. What's really fantastic from my point of view is that companies are actually taking the lead, and now we can take a step back and really monitor and measure whether they're doing what they say they're doing, as you mentioned before, and really help them understand how to tackle new problems, because we're not through this yet. To get to 2050, when population peaks, we're going to have to be very, very efficient.
9.5 billion people or somewhere in that range. We've got some challenges, but Jason, it's been a pleasure. I've been talking with Jason Clay. He's the Senior Vice President for Markets for the World Wildlife Fund. We're going to keep reading your releases and your blogs and your articles, and perhaps we can do this again in a couple of years.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I look forward to it.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.